Burgess, Rich Holman, and Louis LeBlanc at the bottom there, and a tiny bit from a paper that Ghazal and I proposed for a summer undergraduate student, Tomas Galvez-Garci, and finished with help from Federico Piazza. But mostly what I want to do in my short time is give you an overview of what's been going on, because there's been a sort of resurgence of people talking about these infrared issues recently, and tell you why I think it's actually an important part of the conversation that is taking place here. So first, just to make sure everybody is on the same page, let me remind you of the most sort of simplistic, naive place that you might have encountered before, this idea that there's some sort of an infrared issue in De Sitter space. And I'm going to first consider a massive field, and I'm always going to indicate the mass in this ratio with respect to Hubble. And suppose I want to compute just the expectation value phi squared of x. So the calculation that you've probably seen in André Linde's textbook is one where I ask about the difference between a particular conformal time, that's a star h star at the top, and I ask about the contribution of some set of modes that exited the horizon from some earlier time, delta t. That's supposed to be what this picture is, the blue part on the side there. And you probably know that this is the answer. And if I expand that exponential for short times, it looks like this thing is growing with time. And of course, if I take the limit that delta t goes to infinity, I get a finite answer that depends on the mass. And if I did the same thing for a massless field, I would have apparently gotten the fact that this thing just grows linearly with time. Okay. So a lot of people are probably going infrared again, because a lot of the discussion that's been taking place in the past couple of years in some ways looks like a repeat of discussions that happened in the late 70s, early 80s, when people first realized, you know, that we have to talk about how to talk about scalar fields, massless scalar fields in De Sitter space. So why are we talking about this again, and what's actually happening that's new? The thing that's new, genuinely, the reason it's come up is because we have better data, right? Cosmological data. And that data, in particular, is now sensitive to things beyond the tree-level two-point function. So infrared issues, genuinely, are issues that for the most part, you have to deal with when you have interactions. You want to compute loops. You want to look at higher-order functions. And so until the data is sensitive to those things, it didn't really matter necessarily what the answer was, at least according to observational people. And people who were doing this theoretically didn't have to take into account things like, you know, it's not exact eternal De Sitter space. We might not want to use bunch Davies, things like that. So all this is coming back again because we think that there's a potential from the data to actually constrain the patterns that we would expect if the theory that we think we're testing is really classical scalar field inflation, where that scalar field is coming from, you know, somewhere in our spectrum of fields at high energies. And that's where this has started as sort of a thing that people do for inflation if they want to try to match a scenario to the data accurately. But of course, what's coming out of it, again, is that this is also a direction where we can try to test the idea of classical scalar field inflation more deeply. So just to give you a particular example, just to drive home the point, what I put here is the action for what I think, if you're really thinking that you're going to get inflation, you know, forgetting about arrow of time issue, forgetting about initial condition issues, if you're really going to get inflation as some scalar field, it's probably going to be a field that has some sort of shift symmetry. So this is sort of updated natural inflation, where updated just means I've written now every conceivable term on the top line that's compatible with a field that has an exact shift symmetry. And on the second line, I've written some terms that break that symmetry either explicitly or by some non-perturbative effects. And the point I want to make is that if you think this is your theory, and especially if you think there's a reason to have a mass scale or some other fields that live between Hubble and M. Planck, then this could very well be it, and these things are large enough to be observable. And in particular, each of those terms gives you a very precise prediction for what you might want to write down for a three-point function, which you can distinguish and you can observe. So it's a challenge for people to calculate all of these things, and it's also a challenge to try to observe them. And I especially want to contrast this with something that came up in Tom's talk, because if you see something that's exactly Gaussian, right, we haven't had much success finding a suitable inflaton in our spectrum of high-energy fields, okay? But if you think it's there, there's probably more fields, there's probably multiple mass scales, you might see something like this. If, on the other hand, what's right about scalar field inflation is something a little more fundamental, a little more deep, you might expect it to be very, very, very close to Gaussian. And that's the limit that we're hoping to test within the next decade or so with Planck and with large-scale structure. So this is a really relevant set of observations to pay attention to. Okay. But the real thing is, regardless of whether you start with that particular theory or not, the point is, what we have to deal with when we talk about this issue now related to inflation are that we don't want the matter fields to be spectators. Basically, everything that makes this simple, we want to get rid of. We don't want the fields to be spectators. We really have to have interactions. We do not have exact eternal De Sitter space. There's an end. Presumably, there might have been a start, and we don't have h dot equals 0 in between. The initial state might or might not be the bunch Davies vacuum. We might have started with something that came before inflation, but we want to be able to play with that. And the point is that we want to somehow, from that very non-trivial set of ingredients, make a prediction that we can actually match to observations. And although there exist plenty of techniques that have been applied to massless fields and exactasitter and things like that to get an understanding, we want to use techniques where it's clear exactly what happens when I break any of these ingredients. Okay, let me just remind you first why infrared issues are interaction issues, particularly from an observationist point of view. So I'm going to start with the usual two-point function for zeta, the curvature perturbation. It's like 1 over k cubed plus the factor that converts from the scalar field delta phi. And if I'm an observer, what I probably actually want to compute is the correlation of zeta at two points, x and y, on the sky, right? So very naively, I don't have to worry about UV stuff. This is this e to the minus kr, because there's always something, right, the size of my beam or, you know, something in my physical resolution that cuts off the UV. But naively, it looks like I get an infrared scale, LIR, in my answer, right, coming from the bottom of that integral. And you say, what? You know, that can't be. We're not sensitive to the length of inflation, so what is that scale? Well, the answer is, what I just showed you is not actually what we measure, right? What we measure actually is the value of the field at a particular point, and we want to try to subtract off the background from that value, right, the zeta naught. So the only thing we actually measure are differences between pairs of points, and taking those differences is what allows us to make a statement about the background and the fluctuation about that background, where background is defined by the size of stuff that we actually measure. And when you take those differences, that scale disappears, so it's just not an issue when you ask about the tree-level two-point function. There's no infrared scale here. The only thing that we did is define our observables over the scale of the horizon, which is stuff that we actually measured. Okay, and this is an old picture. You can imagine your theory predicts some large set of modes, right, large box modes. What we actually measure is some finite set of modes, especially if those modes aren't correlated. There's no obstacle. You know, we're not sensitive to that big scale, and it doesn't need to appear in the problem. Things get more interesting when you add interactions. So let me suppose that there's a non-trivial four-point function. And now let me calculate the correction to the two-point function coming from that guy. So I have the same answer on the outside, and then on the inside I'm going to have to do some integral, right, over the same thing that looked like it was divergent when I had it at the tree level. So all of the questions now come back, and it's not so obvious, it's not so trivial anymore how we're going to get rid of any infrared scale. And you might ask yourself, is that integral actually divergent, dk over k? If it isn't, what's regulating it? Like in the first slide, we saw that a massive field doesn't actually have a divergence there. Are observations sensitive to it in the sense that is that coefficient A zero or non-zero, in a sense? And if they're sensitive, if it's not A, are we sensitive to the way that we regulated the integral? And then finally, even if we're doing all this for these what we think are very small corrections for observables, does this procedure give us any lesson of how we can deal with fields in distributed space and inflation in general? Okay. So I'm going to do a toy problem, which is a problem that's been done many times before, but I'm going to do it in a slightly different way, and this is from these two papers at the bottom there. And this is just to not have to deal with all of the issues that I brought up, so I'm going to take a spectator scalar field, but I'm going to give it a quartic interaction and some bare mass and zero. And even though this is a toy problem, it still lets me ask sort of the first set of questions that were on the slide before, as in, do I have an actual divergence, and under what circumstances, and what regulates the infrared, and what do I learn about some of the confusion of apparent infrared issues that exist in the literature by doing this? So the system has been done many times before. It's interesting that a lot of the ways that it was treated had to do, at least in some part, with stochastic inflation. Those are the papers on the top either did entirely stochastic inflation or some piece stochastic inflation. And then much more recently, people have tried to solve the system without stochastic inflation. And then there have been even more recent papers after ours, which is that bottom line there. Yeah, I'm sorry, this should be a typo. This should be delta phi, because now I'm really have exactasitter and this is a spectator. Thank you. That's a mistake. All right, so I have to show you a few slides of mechanics. If you want to ignore it, you can ignore it, but just in case you want to know what I'm drawing. So I'm going to, of course, do the Indian formalism, and I have to evolve my instate in each direction to take the expectation value of that operator O in the middle. So I have two sets of fields, right? Some that come from the left-hand side and go forward in time, others that go backward in time, essentially phi plus and phi minus. Then I have, in principle, four two-point functions between phi plus, phi plus, phi minus, blah, blah, blah. but I really only need two of those, essentially. And those I'm calling GC and GR, the retarded propagator, the Keldysh propagator. And for a massive field, again, the GC, what I'm calling GC, is sort of the familiar piece, H squared over K cubed. And it's going to turn out that I don't really need to worry about the part that's in the limit for K tau large. Most of the contributions to my integrals are going to be from K tau much less than 1, so I'm just showing you a simplified version. The retarded propagator is below. When you double the field, you have two interaction vertices. Those are shown there. And I'm going to use flat slicing, and I'm going to use a bunch of Davies. And again, I remind you, delta is the ratio of the mass squared to Hubble squared. So if I want to do one loop, this is what I've got to do. And we didn't Fourier transform everybody, right? So there's going to be a momentum integral over the through momentum. There's going to be a time integral over the vertex, the time of the interaction vertex. And let's do those one by one, because each piece is where people sometimes find these terms that look like they're growing in the infrared. Let's do the momentum integral first. So what I put for limits of integration are some UV cutoff and some IR cutoff at the moment, and both of those are physical scales. The UV cutoff is going to be replaced, of course, by my renormalization scale. Let me just have that be some fixed physical scale above H. And at the moment, I've put an infrared cutoff that's physical. But since this is a massless field, we saw that I didn't actually need that. I can take that guy to zero, right? It's the mass, in fact, that makes it finite. And so the term that I have that's relevant is actually the first term. Now, the important thing here that's going to come back up is had I put a co-moving scale, had I assumed I had something like a beginning to inflation and put a co-moving scale in the bottom of that integral, I would have had an extra log of A, essentially. I would have had something that was growing with time, just like that calculation we did on the first page where we assumed we wanted to ask about all the modes that exited the horizon since some co-moving time. So often when people do this, they put explicitly a beginning to inflation. Even if they're working in exact etc., they put a co-moving cutoff and they get H cubed T's. Okay? But here we're not going to worry about those because I can put a physical cutoff. Okay, so all that stuff is out in front, and then we have the time integral. And the time integral, the reason I'm showing it to you essentially is that, again, most of the contribution is coming from modes outside the horizon, this long wavelength limit. So my limits of integration are 1 over k, the mode I'm interested in, to tau, the time I'm interested in. And we look at the answer. And we've got basically the renormalization scale appearing. The only sense in which there's an infrared scale is that we've got h. But we do have this log of minus k tau, which looks like, again, it's growing with time. So what do we do? Is that a divergence? Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's the point in some sense, yeah. Right? Because we saw on the first page that we looked like we were getting terms that were growing with time. Although in some sense, those were different, right? Because those were the coming from the co-moving cutoff there. All right, so I made a point that... But still, the point is, we know that this isn't a real effect in some sense, and we can resum those guys. So lots of different people have tried to resum those in different ways, most notably stochastic inflation. We used what we think is a nice technique because it's slightly, at least to me, more transparent what it's doing, and it goes by the name of dynamical renormalization group. Essentially, it's just a technique like the renormalization group for summing up leading long corrections, except in this case it applies to things that are growing with time. But it's the same type of mathematical process. When you apply that to sum up these log corrections, what you find, indeed, is that sum just shifts the mass for you. And that delta M, capital delta M on the right there, is showing you the shift in the mass coming from this technique. Okay. So you do a little bit of work. We did basically a large N limit. You can write an equation for the physical mass in terms of the bare mass and this thermal-like correction, this thermal mass. And you can plot it. So I'm showing here a plot of the physical mass m naught squared and the physical mass m squared and the bare mass m naught squared. And basically you see that it's consistent with something that people have said for some time, right, which is that there are no second-order phase transitions into sitter. So it's well known, at least in this audience since yesterday, that there are no first-order phase transitions. It may not have been well known, although it's been well known since 1985, but apparently there are no second-order phase transitions. So this is at least consistent with that. But it's nice because you showed how even if you started with a physical mass of zero, you do have a thermal mass. And that sort of saves you. So it's worthwhile actually to compare this a little more closely with thermal field theory, just because a lot of the time we make these statements that de sitter is a thermal space, and it's interesting to ask, you know, how precise those statements are. And so on the left-hand side, I'm showing you the plot of the same effect in thermal field theory, so the dynamical mass coming from a temperature, and I'm also showing you the dynamical mass coming from de sitter. So there are a few things to compare here, and that's shown in this table. So let's start on the far left. The far left column is showing you the value of the mass, the physical mass, for which perturbation theory breaks down, essentially, right? For which the loop corrections genuinely become order one. For thermal field theory, lambda t. For de Sitter, root lambda h. The second column is showing you the dynamical mass. This is the mass generated either by the temperature or by de Sitter. It looks similar, except it's root lambda in thermal field theory, lambda to the 1/4 in de Sitter. And the interesting point that you can also see from the graphs is that the first column is the dashed line on each plot, and the second column is either the value where the curves intersect on the thermal side or the minimum of that plot on the de Sitter side. And you can see that de Sitter never reaches the scale where there's a genuine breakdown of perturbation theory in the same sense that there is in thermal field theory, right, where you actually reach the critical point. And the far column is, of course, just showing you, you know, the region in which this analysis was valid, because once the mass gets of order Hubble, really there should probably be a V over 2 there or something, then the behavior changes. Okay. So what's the point of this? I mean, I think we said something a little bit more precise, maybe about the thermal mass. But what's the bigger point? There's probably two. One is that basically we're trying to figure out what the right technique is, if there is a right technique, that applies to more general situations, like I said, where we don't necessarily have exact de Sitter or we have interesting couplings, things like that. And so we want to compare to something like stochastic, which is the only method that people generally apply for a wide variety of situations. So the interesting thing is this, of course, is consistent. Those graphs that I showed you are all consistent with things that people find by every other calculational method. The thing that's different, to some extent, is something like the coefficient A. What's the precise value that sits in front of that lambda to the 1/4? And that, to some extent, you might be able to understand by asking which diagrams did you actually sum up, right? So to get our actual equation for the physical mass, we had to take a large N expansion, which corresponds to a case where we can write down, we know exactly which loop diagrams we're using. And so, of course, you know you're not counting some things. And when you go back and you go to N equals 1, then you're probably missing something. So anyway, it's interesting to try to figure out, you know, how precise we can be and with which techniques to figure out the full answer. The other thing that maybe we're learning, at least, you know, for things that we want to eventually get to calculate that we observe, is we're sort of learning which part of this seemingly infinite space is relevant, right? I mean, the most simple lesson of the very first slide is that you thought because you had infinite modes outside the horizon that you had an infinite answer. Of course, that's not true, right, because there's only part of that space that actually matters, which you could also see by going to the sphere, something like that. But when we get into situations that aren't so simple, can we figure out which modes are relevant? And so one way we can do that is go back to this picture of asking what's phi squared of x and expanding to see where sort of the difference between the massless field and the massive field comes in, to identify the scale, essentially, that's effectively the infrared scale that's at work here because of that mass. And what we're doing here is we're choosing some time to evaluate this propagator, right, or this two-point function, tau eval, which is a completely arbitrary time because we're in just exact de Sitter. So it doesn't matter where I put tau eval. But the point is, the thing that sort of cuts me off, I can write as a ratio of tau eval by how large the mass is, and that's that scale over there. And that's the important interval regardless, right? So those times didn't mean anything. And I can move that box anywhere. What's important is just the interval that was actually relevant, right? The amount of stuff I had to consider when I did the integral. Okay. But that was a toy situation, right? In some ways, it's not the situation that we're interested in when we actually want inflation to end. So what's the status of doing this again in the case where we don't have exact de Sitter space? So I'm showing you now results from Martin Sloth and from Giddings and Sloth, which are done by a very different technique, which is very clever, but it's a much, in some ways, simpler technique. But the answer seems to be reasonable, and it helps us pinpoint where things like deviations from exact de Sitter enter. So I'm showing you corrections to now this is genuinely the curvature two-point function and the tensor two-point function, coming from loops of both scalar modes and tensor modes. So the first important thing is that the coefficients out in front, these alphas, depend on the deviation of those different spectra from scale invariant, or from what they would be in exact de Sitter space. So in other words, if I have ns minus 1, if I have h dot equal exactly 0, these things are 0. The other interesting thing is what are these zeta x stars that I have in brackets, right? What are those things? Those things are actually slightly reminiscent, thank you, back to the slide that I had on the first page, because what we're doing now is we're choosing, essentially, again, a time that we're interested in, and we're choosing a particular scalar mode to evaluate. So essentially, they're saying we're going to cut off those integrals by the time that inflation begins. So let's call that tau initial. And the tau eval that we're talking about is based on the mode, right? It's the horizon crossing value for each mode. So let me call that tau eval. And again, in principle, there's probably some physical scale related to the mass or whatever that I could have used for an infrared cutoff. And so let me put that scale again back on the far left there. So part of their point, which I'll get to also in a minute, is that, again, looking at these things naively, they look like they go like h cubed t. So they look like they're growing with time. So what are we going to do about that? Okay. But part of the point is that actually, again, we can ask which part of the whole space of what seems like an infinite modes we actually need to consider here. So let me actually take this diagram and draw it for you for all k, right? Because that time on the far right-hand side is set by which k mode, whose power spectrum it is, they want to calculate the correction to. So let me go back to the mode that first exited inflation. So now my horizon crossing mode corresponds with my beginning of inflation. Let me draw you a graph for k's that exit ever since then. So they're going to move along this line of k tau equal 1 minus k tau equal 1. And if I think I have a beginning to inflation, then the shaded region is what their integrals are counting, right? And after that, if the modes are long enough from the beginning of inflation, obviously they don't see it, they're not sensitive to it, so the part that I'm counting is that. Except for the tensors, where I'm actually counting the whole thing, apparently. Okay? Okay. So what are we supposed to do with all this? Well, one thing at least that Steve Gittings in particular has been interested in and many other people, it also came up a little bit in Leonardo's talk the other day, is that there's still something interesting going on. If I have that beginning to inflation that's cutting off my integrals, there still seems to be this h cubed t there, maybe. Okay. And if I say that means that these, I assume now basically that I've resummed as much as I can into the background, and then I talk about the perturbations on top of that, then it still appears like there is some time for which these corrections become large. And that time, conveniently, because basically we have only one scale plus the Planck scale, can be organized in terms of the radius of the de Sitter space and the entropy of the de Sitter space, which is a scale that comes up a lot and which is interesting for black holes. So does that mean that if we work hard enough, we can find some sort of precise analogy and some sort of interesting infrared puzzle, if you like, or infrared hint that there's something interesting that's comparable to what we can do with black holes? And it seems that that has to come from something that is not exact de Sitter. We somehow want to sit on this boundary where we have stochastic eternal inflation, so the quantum behavior is dominating in some sense. But it's not clear exactly, to me anyway, what the analogy is. So different people have made different versions of the analogy, but it's not obvious to me that we have exactly the right one yet. So that seems to be a possibility. The other thing is much more mundane, but possibly also very illuminating, which is just that we have to know how it is, for cases where it's not so obvious how to rescale the background, how to match these calculations to what we observe. So in the case of the two-point function, we saw that if we look at the tree-level thing, there's no infrared effect, it's just zero. In general, of course, these corrections might just do something sort of simple, like rescale the amplitude or rescale ns minus 1. Okay, not a big deal, but if you want to try to match your theory to a prediction, that should be in there. It's slightly less trivial, maybe, when you talk about the three-point. And part of the reason is that we've all gotten very hung up on the precise shape of the bispectrum as a means of distinguishing between different models, right? Because we know that there are different interesting limits that tell us that different physics is at work. You know, if the model is squeezed is biggest in the squeeze limit versus the equilateral limit, we know it's some kind of local interaction versus a self-derivative and self-interaction, things like that. So we need to be very clear, very careful on to what extent we can, you know, merge those things and confuse those things based on how many modes we're talking about besides the ones that we can actually observe. So that's sort of a practical question. It also comes up because, of course, people, to compare with many observations, people do simulations. When you do a simulation, you take a very small box and you extrapolate to what you see in the universe. So you need to make sure you understand how to make the best representation of whatever you think the real physics is within that finite volume. Okay, so let me just summarize then. Basically, observations care about interactions, right? We really have moved to a new era of cosmology where we're looking at much less trivial information. We're looking at more interesting, detailed stuff. And those interactions are going to be the only thing that we have to tell us, you know, the only observational data we have to tell us if we're on the right track with inflation or not. The interesting calculational thing is that once you start putting in interactions, these infrared issues are inevitable. They're simple to deal with in simple cases, but whether we really understand how to deal with them for, you know, not exact, not eternal de Sitter, for different possible initial states, you know, interacting fields with arbitrary strength interactions, perhaps, that's not so clear. So that's something we still need to work on. And let me just finally show you the outcome of the workshop that we had on this a year ago. So an entire workshop, so I'm not giving a fair summary of everything. But basically, there's, of course, the extreme conservative approach to this, right, which observationalists might take, which is, why do we care? You're talking about some tiny loop effect. I'm never going to see it. You know, whatever. Why do we care? And then there's the extreme, I don't want to call it left wing, but I will just for contrast, the most dramatic side, which is, you know, is De Sitter stable? What are we doing? Do we understand anything? You know, is there some very deep puzzle here related to black holes? And you might think the sides would never talk to each other, except that we have to, right? The reality is that we have to find out, are we an exact De Sitter, quasi De Sitter, and do we understand what's going on? So thank you.
So actually, I guess I was going to ask about sort of more about this, what you call the left wing. Do you actually think that there are, based on the calculations that you've done, that there actually are large effects coming from loop diagrams, or is it, you know, for doing cosmology? I just couldn't quite tell.
So here's the thing. I mean, obviously, if you ask, is the amplitude of any individual effect large? It's clearly no, right, especially in slow-roll inflation. And even if you boost up the effects as big as you want, you're bounded by non-Gaussianity, you know, observationally about how big that effect could be. On the other hand, if you ask, are effects large in the sense that what I thought was the exact shape of the bispectrum is not the shape of the bispectrum, but it's twisted by something of order of the spectral index, which is observable, then I don't know, honestly, because we haven't got there yet. So
that's very different from what people like Polyakov are saying.
Right, so that's a completely different thing that I'm saying, right? And I'm sure there are many people in the audience who would be happy to talk about what Polyakov is saying, but let me stick with that for the moment.
Other questions? Okay, well, why don't we thank the speaker again?